You can't see it, but Cassie's doing little meerkat hands digging a tunnel.
I'm crawling. I'm digging my hole.
Everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Who Is My Doctor?
Who is my doctor?
Who is indeed? I'm your host, Zach, and I know a lot about Doctor Who.
I'm also your host, Cassie, and I know something you don't know.
What? What's going on?
Hey, Zach, are you sitting comfortably?
Yeah. I mean, in my usual spot, we're doing
good, excellent. Now tell me everything you know about the Doctor Who intros, theme song, whatever you'd like to call it.
Everything I know about it?
I would like you to say everything that you can possibly think of. Every factoid, every person involved.
Okay, I know there's been...
Boil it down for you if that would be easier. This is specifically... I'm specifically looking for factoids about the original Doctor Who theme song.
I mean, I don't know much about the original Doctor Who theme. I know more about the production side of things. I don't know about the
whatever
the song itself.
Stuff you have.
When I say the production, I don't mean like the sound production. I mean like the filming of the show, the like creation of the show. I don't know much about the theme song itself.
Well, then, like, what names can you think of associated with the theme song?
I honestly don't. I don't have any names associated with the theme song.
Seriously. There's three I have written down that you've said before.
I mean, is Verity Lambert one of them or
no?
Okay.
Murray Gold is.
Oh yeah, Murray Gold is. He's one of the. He's the current. Where we're watching in the show, he is the conductor and composer at the current stage of the show we're watching, and is also the current conductor and composer for the BBC Orchestra. There was a brief gap during the 13th Doctor's era where it was a different composer, but he is back already. So Murray Gold is a name I know.
What about Eric Winstone or Ron Grainer?
Neither of those names ring a bell to me.
Well, hi there, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Cassie, and I know something that Zach doesn't know, apparently way more than I thought. So yes, Murray Gold is definitely somebody that I would expect you to know. Let me ask you this then. What can you tell me about the production design, sound design of the original Doctor Who? Spoiler alert, you're wrong.
Okay. Okay.
You're wrong about a lot of things. You've been wrong for a very long time, actually.
Okay.
For fairness, I've also been wrong about some things. However, I'm allowed to be wrong because I don't know a lot about this show. I didn't until I went down my own little rabbit hole. I went back to our first episode of the podcast. Mm-hmm. And one of the very first questions you asked me was, what is your impression of the theme song? You said, and I quote, that the theremin is a key element of the theme song and a through line for all iterations of the theme. Is that or is that not correct?
I was under the impression that was correct.
That isn't a theremin.
Oh, is it not? Okay.
No, it's not actually any kind of musical instrument, technically.
Okay.
Some of the other things that, like I said, where I still stand by my statement of space. So big. In the interest of comedy, I will still stand by that. But I neglected to consider way more things when I first approached the theme song.
Okay.
Also, in fairness, the first time that I had heard the theme song was in that very moment.
Mm-hmm.
Aside from like the things that we had watched together, like Solar Opposites, Rick and Morty, things that were influenced greatly mm-hmm. by the Doctor Who theme song. But I was correct in saying that the sounds in the theme song were not of this world.
Okay.
I was wrong. It was not composed by a science monkey.
just a monkey in an astronaut suit.
Well,
with a,
I said
with a baton.
That if you told an ape to sit down at a keyboard and plunk out what they thought space sounded like, it's way more complex than that.
Okay.
But it is something like music, but it isn't music. There isn't a jingle. I don't really know what I'd meant by hyper neo-futurism. Even to this day, I am correct in my, like, it's very 60s-sounding, 60s headspace thinking about what the future would sound like.
Mm-hmm.
However, it's nebulous, which is a word that I used quite often in that, and this is the only time I'm going to say it,
okay,
in this particular one. I typed it out once, never again. But it's for that very reason that I wanted us to do this episode today.
I'm excited. I get to learn new things.
Yeah. If any of you haven't caught on yet, I do know something that Zach doesn't know. Months ago, like I think legitimately like 3 or 4 months ago, I was scrolling through Instagram and the almighty algorithm caught me and showed me a video of a particular person.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is going to be an episode about a person having everything to do with the theme song, but not entirely.
Okay.
I was trying to lead you astray a little bit. I don't know if you caught on to that. But about a particular person that I personally had never heard of. And I even asked you later on that evening, does this name ring any bells for you? Without any context. And you said no.
No.
And you did not list them at all. You didn't list anybody.
I mean, once I knew that you wanted to do this episode, I very deliberately tried to avoid doing any research on things in Classic Who that I didn't already know about, because I didn't want to accidentally stumble into.
Clear your mind.
Yeah, I didn't want to. I didn't
forget everything.
I didn't want to ruin what seemed like something you were really excited about. So
yes.
I wanted this to be your little treat. So I definitely.
Oh, thank you, Zach. Thank you for my little treat.
I mean, I didn't want to sour it by being like, oh, I know all this stuff already.
Jerk. I've even like dropped little hints here and there to see if you would catch on to anything, and you simply did not. Be that as it may, this particular person really struck my interest as a woman in the arts in the 1960s, which, if you know anything about feminism in the 60s, highly unusual for women to be involved in any sort of like media production. Set aside some of those like Lucille Ball. We know her very deliberately from I Love Lucy. And, you know, there's a lot of female actors, but not a lot of times are there women in production, specifically women who are synonymous now with something so iconic as theme songs.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's Doctor Who has a lot to do with that. I mentioned earlier the name Verity Lambert.
Mm-hmm.
She was effectively the first showrunner for Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
In the 60s, they didn't have a traditional showrunner.
No.
A showrunner now is like a combination of a producer and a head writer or a script editor.
Particularly since this is 1963.
Yeah.
And this was a newish idea.
Yeah. So it was, well, what I mean is just that wasn't how TV was structured back then.
No.
On the creative side of things. And now we have this title of showrunner, but, you know, effectively, Verity Lambert was the first showrunner for Doctor Who, and she, you know, as I've said many times with her pronouns, she was a woman in the 60s who running the show.
So we're already getting off onto a good foot. Zach, it's time for the Zachy Profacky.
The Zachary Professory.
No, the Zachy Profacky. You know the rules of the game.
Yep.
It'll operate very similar to the Cassie Profassi.
I get to have points if I get any at all.
Yeah. As we've established, theremin is not at all the instrument.
Okay.
I would like you to tell me what you think the instrument is. Instruments that are used to make the thing. Now, in fairness, I will have us listen to or watch the first or the shorter version of the of the thingy, just for fairness, because I don't think it's fair for me to just throw you into the ringer and say yes. So,
alrighty, let's hear the original 1963 Doctor Who theme.
So this is actually a two-part question. It's 2 points. Okay. You are eligible to get 2 points. The first question is, what instruments are used to make the sounds you hear in the original theme song?
Okay. I mean, there's a few different guesses. I mean, if I know it's not a theremin, I mean, I feel like it would be cheating to say like an electronic keyboard in some way. Okay. That's specifically sampling the sound of something. I feel like that's probably the dun 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 is probably like some kind of Casio keyboard. There's definitely some kind of like sand that's like hissing in the background. If I had to guess, almost want to say it's like some kind of liquid. If it's like almost like you know, like when you, if you would like play glasses with liquid in them.
Okay,
like,
yeah.
I almost feel like there's that kind of element to it.
Interesting.
From like the warbliness of it, but mm-hmm. I mean those are going to be all my guesses, I guess. I would say some kind of electric keyboard sampling some kind of sound that has been modified, and then mm-hmm. there's that like hissing sand noise, and then I'll say literally glasses with water or some kind of liquid in them.
Okay. And how are the visuals made?
This one I
put in, it doesn't really have to do with the person in particular.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to see if your video editing mind could figure out how this was done without...
Yeah, because there's no computer effects mm-hmm. at this time. There's barely even computers in this time.
Nope. Because it's tactile. Everything is practical. And
uh-huh. They're definitely using... It's definitely using almost strictly light. If I had to guess, the specific title Doctor Who was probably filmed as a separate element and then laid over the textures that they have going on. But then looking at the textures themselves, I would assume that it's some kind of bright light shining on, or shining through rather, probably a black cloth of some kind. And I would assume it's coming from different angles, because I think the opening shot is it coming from behind the curtain, so it's shining through like a little hole, like a little slit. And then I think when you've got more of the ripples, it's probably shining on the front, and there's a fabric that's moving to provide that sort of warbly effect during the later half of the sequence there.
Okay.
So... my guess is effectively light and fabric.
Okay. And this one isn't for points. I'm just curious. How does the theme song make you feel? But seriously, how does it make you feel? It just put yourself. We'll time travel a little bit through space and time itself.
I mean, it definitely makes you feel a little uneasy.
Okay.
Partly because there is a lot of... a lot of half step movements, like
yeah,
like it's I've got the it sounds a lot like the dramatic hedgehog meme.
I mean, you're not entirely wrong.
Yeah, because there's something where it's a lot of minor. I don't know if it's minor keys, but they're at least mm-hmm. the chords in them are probably minor chords, and so it's meant to make you a little more uncomfortable.
I do have the sheet music for that somewhere on my computer.
No, in fact, I do know it's a minor chord, because when I was doing when I was making our tracks for this, I had based it on the Doctor Who theme song. So I can't remember exactly what key. I think it's C minor. This is editing Zach letting you know it is E minor, not C minor. Anyway, but I know for a fact it's a minor key. And so those minor keys in general are meant to generally speaking, not universally true, but minor keys in general are what we more associate with sadder emotions, because they're tenser. The chords in them are a little more don't resolve as nicely as they do in major keys. So there's a stronger tension in minor keys than there are in major keys. Mm-hmm. So that's not universally true. There are plenty of happy minor key songs, but as a general rule, minor keys are sadder, more tense, angrier. As a general rule, that's the case. I definitely think that it is meant to give you like this tense, but like a mystery kind of feel.
It's definitely off-putting, almost.
Yeah.
And
especially the original.
Unfamiliar for definitely.
Yeah, because it's been cleaned up a lot for the show you and I have been watching so far.
Yes. Yes, it has.
Yeah. And it gets even more cleaned up as the show goes on.
Well, yeah, we'll get into the irony of that.
Mm-hmm. I'm really excited for you to see some of the future ones now that we're talking about
this. I'm really excited for you to learn about how you've been wrong.
All
right. So let's journey through space and time.
I'll put an echo on that for you.
Do you like that I reference myself? Anyways, but our story actually begins in the Maida Vale BBC studios.
Okay.
Which began its life in 1909 as a roller rink, and then in the 1930s was acquired by the BBC, gutted and reformed into a news station, was struck down during World War II because it was a news station, reformed again, and then on the 1st of April 1958, room 13 in that very same building became the home of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop.
Okay.
Are you familiar with any of that?
I mean, I've heard of the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, but that's as far as I could say. I know it exists.
Okay. They are sound engineers and artists, which back then were simply referred to as assistants, collaborated to create the musical atmospheres and sound effects for radio dramas. And then in 1963, with the decline of the media's popularity, it pivoted to crafting sound effects for television programming. And there is where we meet our very special assistant.
Okay. I mean, that makes sense. It's definitely got like a very the Doctor Who, at least, especially the original theme, has a very strong like radio theme sort of feel
absolutely.
To it. Yeah. So
it's being made almost directly during that shift of one thing to the other.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Zach, I'm going to ask you now, do you remember me talking about Delia Derbyshire?
I do not.
Well, she was born on May 5th, 1937 in Coventry, Warwickshire, England.
Hey, a Taurus.
I practice saying that place in particular, because I knew I was going to mix it up. But she was born into an upper working class family, a precocious child, deeply curious about the world around her and interested in music and math.
Okay.
At 4 years old, she was responsible for teaching her other classmates how to read and to write, but was more interested in music and would later on even say that the radio was her education.
Mm-hmm. It's a 1950s version of an iPad baby.
1940s.
Oh, 1940s.
Yeah. Well, she was born in 1937.
Oh, you're right. Yep. That is the math on that.
Yep. This is during the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot going on. So you can imagine a small child taking solace and comfort in the radio and into things that are way more optimistic than genocide. But by 1956, so 16 years later, the 20-year-old Delia had been accepted to Oxford and Cambridge University.
Wow.
Fancy. Yeah, quite something for a working class girl in the 50s where only 1 in 10 students were female.
Wow.
I know. Sexism. Yeah. That, this was also during the time where...
And she was 20?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. But, you know, also considering 1956, this is during the time where a woman's job truly was to be a housewife, to, you know, do homely domestic. There we go.
Does the queen do the housework?
But, you know, that's during that time, so it wasn't super common for women to go to higher education.
Yeah.
Particularly not in... she got a mathematics scholarship from Cambridge, so she went there.
Okay.
And then after 1 year of study, switched her focus to music. Medieval and modern music history, to be more specific.
Medieval and modern?
Yeah, medieval music and then modern
music.
Oh,
okay, gotcha.
Yeah, they're two different things.
No, I thought it was, at first I thought it had been like one
medieval music history and then modern music.
Yes, that makes sense.
Can't really call it history, but it's the study of modern music.
Yes, no, that makes sense. I thought it had been like one subject with both things, and I was like, that's a weird...
Medieval and modern?
Yeah, I was like, there's a weird gap there in the middle.
You know, just... everything else that's happened.
Classical, neoclassical, baroque. Yeah. This is straight from medieval to modern.
Never mind all that. she graduated in 1959 with a BA in both mathematics and music.
Okay.
Because of that, because of her interest and her like special skills for math and music, I'm avoiding saying the term autistic because I don't know that for a fact. We can just definitely cash in on Delia's very neurodivergent.
There's a non-zero percent chance.
There's a non-zero percent chance, but definitely, definitely neurodivergent for sure. But because of her interest in math, would take a very mathematical approach to music. She would plot out notes on graph paper, observe and listen to the world around her, and would oftentimes find music and melodies in the most unlikely of places. For example, she considered the air raid sirens from her girlhood to be, quote, like electronic music because of their ambiguous origin and abstract sound, unquote.
Mm-hmm.
She was captivated by unusual sounds and would ultimately create one of the most unique methods for making music, utilizing a combination of mathematics, tape records, about a dozen different machines, and a single recording device.
Wow.
Yeah. After we do all this, I will have you listen to some of her other things that are not Doctor Who related.
Okay.
It's just kind of ooky spooky, very really scary. I listened to one today in the car. I was getting ready for this recording. In November of 1960, she joined the BBC as a trainee assistant studio manager and worked on a show called Record Review.
Okay.
Are you familiar with that?
I am not familiar with that at all.
Okay. Basically, critics would review classical music recordings. And much to their amazement, she could hold records up to the light and see precisely where certain parts of the music lived. So if a critic couldn't specify what time something happened, but knew it was like where the trombones came in,
mm-hmm,
Delia could hold the record up to the light, see and like visually see where that like change happened on the record, and then put the record back down and plop the needle directly on that spot.
Nice.
And people called it magic.
Magic.
But it was while she was working on that show that she caught wind of the newly renovated radiophonics workshop at Maida Vale and decided that that's where she wanted to work, which was also a little odd because people were not requesting and chomping at the bit to go to the radiophonics workshop.
Mm-hmm.
People were usually...
Unless you were a big nerd.
People were assigned to go there and didn't really love it because it was a site... like out of the way and just kind of not in the middle of nowhere, but a little bit more remote. But because that's specifically where they had the radiophonics workshop and because that is specifically where they were doing a lot of creating and inventing and sound engineering, that is what drew Delia there because that's what she wanted to do. But seizing the opportunity to work with music and to create, she began her 11-year tenure there in April 1962.
Wow. You know what came out the year after that? Docky Who.
Funny
Davey
should...
Tenney on Docky Who.
It's funny you should say that. I tried really hard to find any sort of like trivia about 1962 or 1963 even, besides that's when the show started. I did learn
that Christopher Eccleston was born February 16th, 1964. So not at all the year that I was looking for.
Well, a lot of that is difficult to keep track of because back then, and this is partly why a lot of episodes are missing, back then the BBC had basically limited space.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't, you know, everything had to be stored on paper or on film. And so a lot of their films either got burned or got mm-hmm. taped over.
Mm-hmm.
This was a fairly prominent point recently when in the 60th anniversary special, Neil Patrick Harris returned as a character called the Celestial Toymaker, who was a character that the first Doctor went against. But the original Celestial Toymaker story doesn't exist anymore.
Mm.
And there were people on Twitter that I saw being like, what do you mean it doesn't exist? Surely it exists. And they went, no.
Yeah.
Because the BBC, in order to maintain space, there weren't reruns back then.
No.
So a lot of this stuff, once it was done, like once the paperwork had been filed, mm-hmm. once they didn't need it for tax purposes anymore, they didn't need it for broadcast anymore, those things were gone. So part of the reason why there's not a lot of trivia for 1963 is because a lot of the stuff that was around in 1963 that would maintain trivia has been destroyed.
Yeah. The only other stuff I could find is that was the year that when I think it was Winston Churchill, maybe I'm like 90% sure, was dubbed an honorary U.S. citizen. And the year that the Beatles recorded their first studio album.
Okay. I mean, those are fun. Those are at least just fun facts.
Yeah. I mean, it has nothing to do with Doctor Who.
So, picture it. The year is 1963. It is the coldest winter that Europe has seen since 1947, I think, was the year.
Okay.
The temperature doesn't have anything to do with Doctor Who. It didn't affect anything. It was just very cold.
So cold, it was called Doctor Who.
Doctor Who. But the BBC has a new sci-fi show in pre-production that is unlike anything that had been on television before.
Mm-hmm.
And was in dire need of a captivating theme song to find its audience. Ron Grainer had been commissioned to write the titular theme song, already having dozens of other theme songs under his belt.
Mm-hmm.
He was the perfect candidate.
Written on a single sheet of A4 manuscript paper, the basic melody and bassline parts were handed over to the Radiophonic Workshop and landed in the lap of Delia Derbyshire
and her associate, Dick Mills. They were tasked with making something kind of like a demo, a rough draft demo, is the better word for that.
Yeah, I think demo is the right term.
That would be handed back over to Grainer to be overdubbed with the small orchestra.
Recorded, and then that would be the intro for the show. That did not.
Yeah, I was gonna say that's definitely
super didn't.
That
happen.
Is 100% not an orchestra playing that original theme.
No, and we will get more into all of that right after these short messages.
Yarr there, you landlubbers. I love being a pirate. The salty sea air, the pillage rum, the freedom from me hag of a wife. But what I don't love are these pesky seagulls that keep making their nests in me beard. That's why I use Doubloon Shave Club to help keep me beard nice and clean. Now me beloved Polly delivers me a new straight razor any time I need a new one, whether it was thrown overboard or plunged into the heart of a filthy scallywag who tried taking my Doubloon Shave Club razor from me. 'Tis that simple, me hearties. This week only, when you subscribe, you get a tasty lemon to help fend off the scurvy. Doubloon Shave Club, because a black beard shouldn't be a nasty beard.
And we are back. That's how you say it, yeah?
That is how I say it.
How you feeling so far, bud?
I'm excited to learn things. I look forward to discovering how definitely that demo track they made is what stayed as the theme song.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's what, as soon as you told me like that didn't happen with, I was like, yeah, there's no orchestra in that. So when that 100% tells me that demo track is what we hear.
Which is also why I'm not upset, because jumping forward into my research a little bit, the theme song stayed the same until 1980. There were a couple changes here and there, uh-huh. but it remained untouched.
Yeah, I think the only thing that they would have really changed was the...
They added extra whooshes and swoops here and there.
Yeah, or they... I know at one point there's like a... sort of sound at the beginning of it, but also the visuals for the intro changed.
Yeah, so
the song itself was pretty unchanged.
It is... it's the fact that now... Because I know that you had said at one point that you were... That, like, you think it's cool that every new doctor, one instrument gets added. And it just makes me sad knowing that there is this gorgeous, meticulous, handmade theme song that exists, but is now so covered in every other instrument. But things need to change.
Well, it was a, what's the term for it? A rearrangement. With the current theme, we could still go back and find this original.
Ugh, but... I know. What's the fact that I'm getting ahead of myself? So I don't know if you remember. I'm sure. I hope you do. Delia was obsessed with found sounds. So remember the air raid siren.
Mm-hmm.
She liked the clinking of coconuts, which technically is, I would consider that a musical instrument just because it's not conventional for Western music or Northwestern music specifically, but you can find it way more in like Polynesian music and in certain parts of South America. So that I would consider a musical instrument.
Okay.
And even individual plucked strings on a stand-up bass.
Yeah.
That's an instrument. But wine glasses at different stages of emptiness.
All right. Yeah.
You were correct about that.
I got one.
However, you did not mention the harmonic waveforms of test tone oscillators used to calibrate sound equipment in a room.
Well, why didn't I think of something obvious like that?
I don't know, but it was things that were not always conventional musical instruments. Those were the types of things that she really liked.
I'm still going to call that a point for the Zach Profaki.
I'm on the fence on if I want to give you the point because you specifically said keyboard.
So I would imagine that the found sounds were recorded and then sampled into a Casio keyboard. But I want to say that if I've given you points for half guesses and I got the liquid in a glass right.
Yeah, but it's how wrong you are about the Casio keyboard. And it is the sheer wrongness of the Casio keyboard. Jumping ahead in my research even more. Delia hated Casio keyboards. She absolutely loathed the like manufactured sound of synthetic electric keyboards like that.
Okay, so to be clear, when I said Casio keyboard, I didn't mean like the built-in piano sound. I mean they recorded a sound and then put it into the sampling board of a Casio keyboard.
But you're wrong about the keyboard. All right. Found sounds. She invented a technique that would later be dubbed music concrete. Is that familiar to you at all? Have you heard that at all?
I've not heard that term before.
All right.
Or I may know this thing, but I don't know. I've not heard it as this term. I'll put it that way.
So what she would do is record any sound that she liked and then adjust them manually by either manipulating the physical magnetic tape. Which for all you kids at home, once upon a time and long ago, sounds were recorded on magnetic tape. And I would love to explain more, but I, for the life of me, do not understand how tapes work.
Fucking magnets. How do they work?
Oh, my God. Because I've even thought about like how VHSs work.
Mm-hmm.
I can't figure it out. I can't figure out cassette tapes. I can't figure out film reels at least make sense because it's a picture, big light. But it's anyways, I would love to explain more for me. Tape, magic, all of this, witchcraft. Everything that Delia is doing is witchcraft. But anyways, she would record whatever sound she liked and manipulate the physical tape by cutting it, rearranging certain sections of the tape, or manually futzing with the tape player itself, speeding it up, slowing it down, stuff like that. So each and every sound was handcrafted.
Oh, interesting.
So the sand, the whooshes, the wine glass, the plucked bass, everything everything was made.
That also explains why some of the notes to it were imprecise.
I will get on that because I have a point about that as well.
Okay.
But yeah, so not sand, the hissing sound, which is I think what you were referring to, is filtered white noise.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. The swoops is an altered oscillator sound.
Okay.
I don't really know, because these are all terms that they use in any document that you find. It's hiss, swoops, bubbles, clouds, and bass. And then something called a wobulator. I could not fucking find anything that described what a wobulator was. Not through Delia's own terms, not through Dick Mills' own terms.
I could tell you what it is.
What is it?
I wob you now, and I wob you later.
Anyways. I tried. So I spent, hey folks, I spent a full fucking day working on this, what you are hearing now. I am reading it from a script, for lack of a better term. I'm calling it my research. I looked up the term wobulator, and everything I could find is it's just being said in quotes. Because I think, much like what you were saying about the BBC not saving anything, I would not be surprised if that's a term for some kind of tool or instrument that they used in the radiophonics workshop, but was not something that was kept around for anything else.
Is it this thing, a wobulator?
Probably, yeah.
Yeah, so I just pulled, I thought, I think, I'm assuming
you're... Because it was in air quotes, I thought it was made up!
I'm assuming they also probably spelled it wrong in whatever they put in the...
Nope, that's exactly how I spelled it, but okay. Google is telling me that it's incorrect.
Oh, okay, interesting.
So that's why I assumed it was fake.
Primarily used for the alignment of receiver or transmitter intermediate frequency strips.
Yeah, so even still, irrespective of it all, it is not a conventional musical instrument.
Yeah, no, it is not. I think this is actually...
The oscillator?
This right here is in Russian.
Yeah, I mean, there is... We can even watch it later on. There is videos of Delia doing this exact thing, and the machine that she's working on looks exactly like that.
Yeah, so it seems like this is more about... It's not a musical instrument necessarily. It is, I think, if I had to guess this, reading just the description of this, I had to assume it's like almost like a military device meant to... obtain certain like radio frequencies.
Okay. I think, yeah.
And so I would assume that it's in the same way, like if you're dialing through radio stations and you find one that isn't there and you just get back like feedback noise.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to guess, I mean, because obviously I know as much about this as you do, because you and I are both finding this on this current Google search.
Yeah.
That it was, she would find frequencies where there wasn't anything and just recorded the noise that came out of that frequency.
Yeah. I do think that does sound correct, because at one point I had the memory of numbers, the number stations.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know anything about those?
Number stations.
They're weird, because it's for those types of things. Mm-hmm. Where it's just these station. I don't know it like precisely, but it's stations that were built during this time of like radio transmit.
Mm-hmm.
That just repeat numbers, letters in infinitum, so that way there's always a signal. Do not take my word for this exactly. I am not an expert in this.
Yeah. This is a grain of salt, Cassie.
I have heard this through another podcast because one of the hosts there is hyper fixated on these number stations for like 2 months. I digress. Key points. Each sound would be recorded and used for specific notes. And then each sound would be further modified, looped on tape. Playback speeds were futzed with until desired pitch was found. These new sounds were then re-recorded on a separate machine. This process was repeated till every sound was available in every pitch needed or every key needed.
Mm-hmm.
And then each sound was spliced together, specific notes of every sound stuck together in their correct order, and then repeated for each line of music to create different tracks. So they would take these sounds and physically cut the tape and then reattach the pieces of sound on the tape.
Well, what's interesting about that is that's sort of also how they make electronic keyboard sounds. So knowing that that's what
oh,
she...
Oh, shut the fuck
no, no, no.
up.
This isn't me saying I'm still right. This is me amused that she hated the electronic keyboard sound so much, but then basically just did it the long way.
I guess. This was 1963.
Yeah, so this is not me trying to be like, I was right after all. This is me amused at this point.
She liked tactile, like, physical things.
Yeah, it sounds a lot like, I mean, you and I have been watching Delicious in Dungeon.
Yeah, and it's the, Senshi says something of like, getting things the hard way makes it taste better.
Yeah, Senshi has a problem with magic because he views it as a shortcut. Even though it gets the same result in the end as what he wants, so it feels like that a little bit, where it's just like, yeah, but you sort of just did the same thing with extra steps.
Yes. So there were three different machines, three different record or not cassette players, not record players. I don't know the name for the machine.
Whatever, the tape player.
Yeah. Thank you. Tape.
Even though that's not the formal name for it, we at least know what it is.
Yeah, so there were three different tape players, each loaded with its own handmade custom reel. So they would be divided by the, quote, tiddly bits on top.
The tiddly bits?
That was the term Dick Mills would refer to them as. The tiddly bits.
This music is powered by the magic of tiddlywinks.
Tiddly bits. Hey, kids. Enjoy your Saturday morning breakfast with Tiddly Bits.
They're full of vitamins and minerals. And Tiddly Bits.
And twiminerals.
Twimerals?
Twidurals. I'll figure it out. Hey, I found our sponsor this week. So the Tiddly Bits, or Twiddly Bits on top, the rhythm, and then the melody. So three different machines.
Okay.
When the recorder was ready, Delia, Dick, and then one other colleague would ready, steady, go, and synchronously press their play buttons. And somehow this worked. If for whatever reason they heard a wrong note, the tape would then be unrolled, the note found, and replaced, retaped. The reel would be replayed. Submixes were created to have different combinations of bars, melodies, hisses, whatever parts of the whole that were working to save on time. Like if there was one section that sounded good, but there was another thing, they would record the section that sounded good and say, cool, here is tape A. This has the twiddly bits on top and the melody, but the rhythm is off. So we need to figure that out. But they would do this. And eventually, after dozens of tedious hours, the song was formed.
Interesting.
It took quite a while.
I don't doubt it, because it's not this. I am a huge proponent of, obviously, as it is my, not my day job, but my day gig. I'm an editor. I edit this podcast. I edit video, film.
I thought you meant pharmaceuticals. I didn't know you were a big fan of what you do.
No, but I'm a big fan of digital editing because I know that it saves this time and it gives more room for creative input in the back end as opposed to on this front end. Like when I had those music tracks done for this, if I wanted to continue working on them once they were made, I could continue working on them. But in this, it's very different, and I do find that there's something that you can't do in digital that you can do with this physical media.
It feels very much, because I think this is another moment where you and I are seeing the same thing, but at very different angles, because I am a way more tactile artist. Mm-hmm. I like sewing. I like things that I can make and finesse for a very long time, but once it's done, it's done. Mm-hmm. It cannot be. After you spray paint varnish on top of a painting, you could go back and edit things and you could finish it, but it is done. If you want to do it over again, or if you want to change something, you have to redo it.
Yeah.
And for me, there's a part of that I enjoy, the redoing it, because then that's when you can go in and add different things, or, you know, I did it this way this time, let me try it a different way the other time.
Yeah.
That's the same rule I have with all of my cosplays. I am never fully done with a cosplay ever.
Mm-hmm.
If for no other reason than because I constantly am learning new things, and I like learn, or I like applying those new things that I learn to whatever costume I'm actively working on. Like a good example is my Raven cosplay.
Mm-hmm.
I did it the first time. I hated the cape. I didn't like many parts of the cosplay itself. I liked the recognition I got from people because I'm very...
You're a sucker for attention.
I am a sucker for attention, and I usually like to cosplay characters that nobody knows and nobody's seen, so I can kind of fly under the radar. But I really like when people recognize who I am, but somebody like Raven is very recognizable. So even if it's a shitty costume, people recognize you. But the second time I did it, it was a little bit more put together.
Mm-hmm.
It's more, has more me in it.
Mm-hmm.
I have only ever worn her out twice,
mm-hmm.
because by the next time that I had thought of wearing it out again and going out into the public, the year was, it was the beginning of the year, 2020.
Mm-hmm.
And we all know what happened in 2020. We all became inside cats.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's very interesting because I read something like this and go, wow, that's incredible. It's this hard... It's a physical, like, you can't, this can't be undone.
Mm-hmm.
This is it. This is the finished piece.
Mm-hmm.
But at first, Ron Grainer didn't recognize his own music. When he heard it for the first time, he looked at Delia and asked, quote, did I write that? And she responded, very nearly. But he was so excited about what had been done with his silly little piece of, his single sheet of music, because
mm-hmm.
it was just the one, that he had scrapped the idea of overdubbing it with a small orchestra, and the theme song stayed the same, almost unchanged, until 1980. And I bet you're wondering, why haven't I heard of Delia Derbyshire before?
I mean, I'm not entirely wondering that. It was the 60s and she was a woman.
So here's the really kind of horrible, tragic part of that is Ron Grainer was so wonderfully impressed and enthralled with what Delia had done with his music. He said, I cannot take the credit for writing this
mm-hmm.
because I wrote it. I did not compose this.
Mm-hmm.
This is all Delia. I would like her credited as a second writer.
Okay.
However, as a workshop assistant, Delia never got the credit that she deserved for defining the sound of Doctor Who. And that's because none of the radiophonic workshop assistants had their names attached to any of the projects on which they contributed. The theory goes that the BBC wanted to keep things anonymous and have the radiophonic workshop operate more like an ensemble. Eventually, the BBC did change their rules and gave their assistants credit where credit is due,
mm-hmm.
but those rulings did not apply to any of their projects retrospectively.
Mm.
So Delia got nothing for the Doctor Who theme song. She didn't have her name written until very recently when curious people, such as myself, but, mm-hmm. you know, people way before me. Fans of the original series did some digging, and then her name started to become more integral to OG Doctor Who.
I will say that's one really nice thing about the Doctor Who community, because there is this lost media aspect to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people that are really dedicated to preserving Doctor Who history,
mm-hmm.
And as such, these stories come out that way.
It reminds me a lot of also something that I have way more experience with, the Disney community, because it the Disney fan, because mm-hmm. a lot of the original Steamboat Willie, Snow White, many of those stills and those frames, they don't exist. They're mm-hmm. gone, because much like the BBC, when Disney first started,
there was no home video
there
release.
There was no collection. Like, there was no, like, collector mentality. Nowadays, they say fucking everything.
Yeah, nowadays, they have a library of...
Oh, they have a full-on... It's really cool, because... fun fact, I used to work at the Disney Studios Starbucks, because they have one there. But they would have not excursions into the archive, but they would have archive displays where they would take things out of the vaults and have them on display for workers, specifically in the building that I worked in.
Okay.
And so for a very long time during the Haunted Mansion 75th anniversary, was it 70 or 75?
I'm not the person to ask that question.
We went to the event.
Yeah, but I don't remember.
Whatever. It was the big one that just happened. During that time, they had the original bride out on display.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, and a lot of the original attic stuffs. Theme park memorabilia, but still very neat, because it got to a point where they realized, oh, we have to save everything. And to be fair, there is a lot of stuff that does get auctioned off in private collections. But here's the thing about the theme song, this one in particular. There were two different versions.
Interesting.
There was the first master of the song, which clocked in at 2 minutes and 19 seconds, which can be found as track number one on Doctor Who Radiophonic Workshop number 6- the early years from 1963 to 1969. Nice. However, this one wasn't designated to be used on the program.
Okay.
It is the first iteration of the track, and that's the one that Ron most likely listened to and went,
what?
That's his mind blowing up. But it required minor adjustments to accommodate for what Bernard Lodge, which I don't think that's a name familiar to you.
Nope, not familiar to me either.
Production designer for the opening visuals.
Oh, fun.
Yeah. For context, he had devised a method of feeding the film output of a video camera optically back onto itself via its own motor, creating a, quote, inventive swirl of howl around. You fucking figure out what that means.
Can I see it written down?
I'm reading it back out. No, because I can't move the computer.
Fair.
Feeding film output of a video camera optically back into itself via its own motor, creating an inventive swirl of howl around. Think of it like when a PA microphone interacts with its own speaker and screams, but visually.
Interesting. So I'm trying to figure out how that
would. So you don't get the point for that one?
No, I don't. I absolutely don't. I'm trying to picture.
I feel bad not giving you the point for it because I truly don't know what that means. I would not doubt that it does the original images itself. I would not be surprised if you are into something with fabric and light and just high and low contrast and double exposure for the Doctor Who title.
Yeah.
That sounds very correct. If you can figure out everything else, though, I will give you the point just because I'm curious.
Well, because I'm having to remember the history of cameras here.
I mean,
because back then
it was the double reels, though. Yeah.
Yeah. More specifically thinking about how the lens worked more than anything else. So there would have been.
You tell me.
I'm trying to remember where the shutter would have been to create, because some of those effects I could understand, because if I'm remembering correctly, back then it wasn't. Right now, what we have, the shutters that we have are irises,
mm-hmm.
which opens and shrinks on itself
like an eyeball.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, and I could be wrong, so please, if I'm wrong and someone knows I'm wrong, tell me. I will happily retweet it and correct
but
the story
here. Nice. Yeah, the same for me. Although I do and do not have a Twitter. I have Schrodinger's Twitter.
Yeah, feel free to message us on at WhimDPod on our various social medias. If I am wrong, I will absolutely set the story straight in any way that I can. But
you can do another episode, an update episode.
If memory serves correctly, they weren't irises back then because the mm-hmm. technology couldn't keep up at the rate it needed to at the time. It was literally like almost, I believe it was a covering that came on and off.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess, or maybe it's spun. No, I don't think it's spun. But I guess that would be how they got that warbly effect. Is they're capturing the shutter itself, obscuring the lens.
I tried to make sense of it. That was another part of my very long day of writing this down, was wrapping my head around. And after I'd gotten the explanation of feedback from a PA microphone. Mm-hmm. I went, oh, that makes sense. But now saying it out loud, because I don't even know how that works.
I mean, I would assume it's some kind, basically it's a...
Because that's sound waves, that's frequencies. This is visual, though.
Well, I mean, in that case, it's effectively they're holding a mirror up to it, and I would assume shining a light through said mirror, so when the camera is getting bounced off of itself, it's basically capturing what's going on in the back of the camera.
I mean, we could also... It's very possible that there is an actual explanation for this. I just didn't bother to look it up. I will say... I will not say. I do have another bonus point that you could get.
And I just, so I have to, so I'm assuming that's primarily for the like wavy effect.
Yeah.
I don't know that that explains like the very first visual where it's that little like almost sparky effect.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know if those are the same thing.
I meant to bring up this bonus point a while back.
Okay.
How are the original how is the TARDIS sound made? Delia didn't have anything to do with this.
Oh, I used to know this.
Delia didn't have anything to do with this, which is why I wasn't going to include it, but I was just so excited about it when I read it.
I'm mad because I definitely used to know this.
Would you like a hint?
Sure.
It has to do with a key.
A key? Like a house key?
Like a house key.
Is it that the key is scraping against something?
Yes.
Okay. Is it scraping against like a cinder block?
No.
Okay.
Think specifically about how, like, Eve's sounds are made in WALL-E.
Okay.
I think it is the same thing.
Okay.
It's keys scraping on piano wires.
Oh, that makes sense. The cinder block I was mixing up with how they made the Balrog sounds in the Lord of the Rings movies. Because that was one of the first, like, sound design things I watched. So cinder blocks now just forever associated with...
keys.
Well, with sound design in my head.
Yeah, mine is always the specific ways that Pixar made Eve's like gun sound.
Okay.
Which was a spring that was stretched super duper far, and then a microphone being held at one end and then somebody whacking the other end.
Yeah.
So it made that like...
Yeah, that makes sense.
Because it's the same... That's the same way that they made these... the gun sounds in Star Wars.
Yeah, and I'm assuming it's probably like a really thick piano wire.
Oh, yeah. Well, because if you look at piano wires,
they're springs.
Yeah.
So when the
but
key
just
is
really tightly.
Yeah, so when this key is scraping along it, it's also.
Shmeep.
Yeah, that's why you're getting the sort of like. Like the like the vibrato of it.
The sound wave for that was so cool.
See, that's what they used to make the TARDIS sounds, was just two people and a microphone going...
I mean, that is how they did the sounds for Mufasa. It's just a man screaming into a metal trash can.
Yeah, this is all it was. It was just two people making whale noises, and then they overlaid it.
Challenge for you, Zach. Mimic the TARDIS sounds, but only with us. Yeah. Back to the theme song and how there are several versions of the same one before it even came out, before the show aired. So we have the big master track.
Okay.
And then from that, we have two separate edits. We have the good edit and the bad edit.
Are you a good edit or a bad edit?
Yes. Because the production team wanted a track that was more flexible and a skosh of the precision removed to make it sound more human. So when you said those like warbly sort of like it's imprecise.
Yeah.
That's exactly why. Because Delia's original track was too precise. And they went, it needs to sound more handmade. And she went,
So they faked a theremin.
Kind of. Yeah. Because they wanted, you know, imprecision and something that was more flexible. A second master was prepared. So I correct myself. There are four. There's two masters. There's the first that's perfect. The second one that's slightly imperfect. And then from that, the second one, there are two, good edit and bad edit.
Okay. So there's a good and a bad, mm-hmm. and then a good bad and a bad bad.
Some of the alterations included the repetition of the bassline loop at the 2 minute mark, the addition of rhythmic hissing. That was sped up and then faded out just before the melody, before the new loop, or just after the melody, before the new loop. deliberate imprecision, and a wind bubble to conclude the track.
A wind bubble?
A wind bubble. That is not a me term. That is a them term.
I'm curious what a wind bubble is.
This is the part.
Is that what's trapped in your cheeks when you blow your cheeks up real big?
So, you know, earlier when I was killing myself because I couldn't fucking find what I needed to, It was that. I don't know if there is actual, like, online good and bad edit of the theme song. I spent a very long time trying to find it. Mm-hmm. Could not find it.
A wind bubble is just a balloon.
You're not wrong. I have my dates mixed up a little bit, and I welcome any criticism or critique. So they had an episode that aired September 27th, 1963 that used the bad edit.
Okay.
So before the end of the melody, before the bass loop takes over, it sounds like the song is heading towards the bridge, but actually loops back around to the beginning of the melody as the ending of the track. This can be found on Radiophonic Workshop's 21st birthday celebration, the track entitled 21. But when The Unearthly Child aired on October 18th, the good edit, which is Doctor Who at the BBC Radiophonic Workshop, number 6, track 5, was finally played on television and stayed virtually the same, save for the occasional whoosh here and hiss there until 1980. I don't know when the bad edit actually happened, because I thought that Doctor Who aired on September, or in September. But then when I went back to, like, look at my own stuff again, an unearthly child is considered the pilot, right? So I don't know when this bad edit happened.
I mean, I would guess that was a pre-production thing.
I suppose so.
Yeah.
So by the time that it was aired on television, They did have the good edit, which might be why I couldn't find the bad edit.
Yeah.
I digress. What are your thoughts right now?
I think this is a really neat story so far.
There is more. I have two more paragraphs.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure you have more about this, but I think it's really cool how this person had a very, like, singular personality that just worked for this song.
Well, she has other stuff that she did for the BBC. For the interest of our podcast,
I should rephrase that. I don't mean just, like, only worked for this song, but I mean her personality worked for her personality would work for this song in the way that it did.
It was a perfect storm of stuff.
Yes.
Because with the combination of the visuals of just the, if we're looking at and isolating the intro alone, it was enough to get people intrigued. Because also when it first aired, people were kind of scared of it. People were frightened.
It makes sense.
Because also, 1963, like, seeing something like this for me now, I'm so excited about it. Because it's a little psychedelic and, you know, electronic music-y.
Yeah, and so many things have been inspired by it
absolutely.
That for you, it's sort of like meeting an old friend all your other friends have talked about.
Yeah, it's coming full circle. This is the family friend at a barbecue that I've heard so many stories about.
Exactly.
I really do encourage you, especially if you're in your car, to listen to some of the stuff that they do have, because we'll get onto it a little bit later, but there are hundreds of recordings of Delia's stuff. Only some of them actually exist on any kind of, like, public platform. Delia ultimately left the BBC in 1973, contributed to a British gothic supernatural horror flick by the name of The Legend of Hell House. She worked on that with an individual by the name of Brian Hodgson, which if you look at any of the recordings that you have available, or that at least are available to me on Spotify, a lot of them are credited to Delia Derbyshire, Brian Hodgson, BBC Radiophonic Workshop. It's usually a combination of two of the three.
Okay.
But 1973, by this point, electronic media had started gaining popularity on the pop music radar. So artists like Pink Floyd and David Bowie, releasing some of their most iconic albums at that time, all featured the haunting monotony of synthesizers and electric pianos. And Delia was not happy with this turn in music, because she missed the tactile nature of physical instruments, whether traditional or non-traditional, and was disappointed with the inorganic quality of the new machinery that was taking over the music scene.
Interesting.
Yeah. So the irony of, like, you of you saying, like, she basically hand-built a Casio, like, you know, keyboard.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time that that stuff actually started coming into play, she didn't like it. She was upset. I don't like it. And so for a while, she produced some of her own compositions in her townhouse attic, but little by little fell into an alcohol-induced depressive slump that would halt her music making almost indefinitely.
Mm.
Not many years later, in the year 2000, Peter Kember, more popularly known as Sonic Boom, reached out to Derbyshire to aid...
Hey, all right.
Are you done?
Yeah.
Jesus.
Sorry, wrong Sonic.
Reached out to Derbyshire to aid him in creating sounds to use on a single track found on a collaborative album called Grain, a compilation of 99 short tracks. She would never hear this track, though.
Mm.
She, in July 2001, she died from renal failure brought on by cancer. She was 64.
Mm.
Yeah. But her legacy lives on. After her death, 267 tapes and hundreds, if not thousands, of sheets of written music were found in her attic.
Mm.
And so, and there are recordings of her work available to listen to online. So, if you, at least for me, if you go on Spotify, there are, you can listen to a lot of that. And some of them are from some of the other stuff that she did for BBC.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them are from the movie soundtrack, but then some of them are original, like, discotheque pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, haunted discotheque. Very scary. If you listen to it in your car... I have wonderful speakers. It got to the point where it was fucking with my brain, like, rhythms, to mm-hmm. the point where I couldn't really see while I was driving. So don't listen to it while you're driving.
It's been raining a lot. You can't see when you're driving anyway.
Yeah. Very ambient, very unsettling. Like I said, the first time the Doctor Who theme played on television, people were afraid and said it was too scary. But it was because it was so unusual for the time. It gave the show its credibility with its, quote, otherworldly cohesion.
Wow.
Which I think is kind of nice.
Okay.
That it was, it's kind of like when, or it reminds me of like when a pilot of a show goes so hard mm-hmm. to weed out the people that are not going to stick around.
Well, it's funny that so much of what made Doctor Who interesting... And, well, not interesting, but captivating, I think it might be the better way to put it, for audiences at the time, was that it was kind of scary.
Yeah.
Not just, yeah. I mean, we're talking about the theme here, but also the second story ever was the Daleks. And the Daleks, you know, for us are a little silly. But, you know, to them, they were genuinely a little scary, especially for kids, and kids fucking ate that shit up.
I'm a kid and I ate that shit up. I also have so many factoids about the Dalek sounds too now because of this.
So what I was briefly looking up here, I must have forgotten. I don't know if the part wasn't that big or if I'm just forgetting. It's been a while since I've watched this, and it's in my list of things for us to get to at some point. As part of the 50th anniversary, in addition to the 50th anniversary special that they had,
mm-hmm.
They had done a few other little celebratory media things. So they had some shorts, including past doctors. They had a little fun story called the Five-ish Doctors reboot, which is a story of the five classic doctors play, like, the actors for them anyway, trying very hard to get into the 50th anniversary. Like, it's the story of these five actors teaming up to break into the BBC studios.
I heard Witch Doctors and I was like, Oh my god.
Yeah, no, the five-ish doctors.
Oh my god, the five witch doctors. They're hags now?
No, the five-ish doctors. Because really it's just four of them, but a fifth one shows up. So they've called it the five-ish doctors.
That's pretty funny.
But one of the things they did was this biopic called An Adventure in Space and Time, which is about...
You said it wrong, Zach. It's An Adventure in Space and Time!
It's called An Adventure in Space and Time, and it's about William Hartnell's run on Doctor Who, starting from the show creation all the way to the end of his tenure. And I looked it up, and Delia Derbyshire is...
Derbyshire, but yes.
Delia Derbyshire is a character in that movie.
Mm.
So she is in that. I don't remember her in it. That's not to say that... I mean, but I haven't seen it in almost 10 years.
Yeah.
So it's been a hot minute. I'm not surprised I forgot details. So I don't know if she had a smaller part and that's why I'm not remembering it, or if it's just because I haven't watched it in a while and I only really remember the broad strokes of the movie at this point.
We will investigate.
I figured we would watch that when we got to the 50th anniversary.
Yeah. Her legacy doesn't stop with just the discovery of all of her music, basically. Mm-hmm. That all went into... Manchester University Archives, I think, because it was discovered and then it handed off to them so that they could keep it. But also 2011 saw the creation of a volunteer-based charity organization called DD Day.
Mm-hmm.
Delia Derbyshire Day.
Nice.
Which has hosted over 50 events and brags a robust archive of some of Delia's works and works that have been inspired by her. And that is... everything I have. Kind of a weird ending that I didn't write for that.
No, I think this was a really fun little story.
Yeah. Now you know what I know. Yay.
I know something you also know.
I taught you a thing I know. But yeah, and like there were some things I admittedly glossed over just because they make me sad to think about, like the fact that a lot of the reason why she didn't get some of the credit that she deserves is because of sexism during the 60s. And I really do appreciate somebody like Ron Grainer saying, hey, can we please list her as second writer because she fucking did something that I could not do even if I tried.
Yeah.
And then the big wigs at BBC saying nah.
Mm-hmm.
Like that just sucks. And it also sucks that even now, you know, 50 years later, is she starting to get more credit for it? I think if you do look up the theme song, she is credited alongside the Radiophonic Workshop.
Mm-hmm.
But that hasn't been, that's been a recent development.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you have to consider that for many years, it was just her name kind of floating around in the ether. Being associated with it, but only if you were interested in finding out. Because if you sincerely, like, go back and listen to some of her other stuff, you can definitely hear where that... And I finally figured out what I meant by hyper-neo-futuralism. Okay. Futuristic. Because when you go back and listen to some of her stuff, it does sound exactly like what people in the 60s imagined the future sounding like.
Yeah.
I had mentioned Tomorrowland, which is very kitschy and very dated, despite it being about the future. But when you really go back and listen to some of the stuff that she was making during that time, you can see where people who might have heard that would start to think like, oh, yes, this is of the future, because it doesn't use violins or stand-up bass guitars, cellos. It's no classical, like, musical instruments. Mm-hmm. It's all of these found sounds that are being not forced together in, like, the bad term. You know, I imagine that these sounds do want to all hang out and be together.
Mm-hmm.
But it's this amalgamation of sound that shouldn't work, but does. And it isn't familiar. It is uncanny.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and because of that, it's not classical in any terms of the word. I think that there is way more influence that she had over the way that electronic music sounds today than we even really know, that I physically right now in this moment can wrap my head around. Needless to say, because I've gone down such a deep, dark hole, I've done such a such a deep, dark dive into this, I am more and more, especially since I tend to listen to a lot of like liminal music, very ambient. There have been times now where I will hear a track and I go, that sounds like Delia. Like, that sounds very tactile. You can hear like the tape rolling by. You can hear, you know, sounds that are not theremins, there are not coconuts. You know, it's an unusual sound. I mean, I guess like nowadays we do have sampling of, you know, individuals taking the sound of a cat meowing and just taking the top pitch of the meow and then pitching it out. And, you know, it's very, it's much quicker. It's not quite as tedious. And you don't need three separate individuals to press a button all at the same time to get a song going, but it's nice to be able to go back and figure out how some of this happens, so that way you know you have more of an appreciation for how things are made today.
Yeah that was a fun little story.
I'm glad you had decided you wanted
to do this little secret episode.
I'll try to figure out another secret episode thingy.
If something else jumps out at you, great. I've certainly got some other ideas that aren't going to be for
I like knowing things though that you don't. I did find an article while I was doing some research about, it was specifically an article that talked about the Dalek sounds and the TARDIS sounds.
Okay, that might be fun for us to do in the future then.
Not secret necessarily, but
who knows what rabbit hole that might send you down.
You already know, just because It's no secret. I love Daleks. They're so stupid.
Yeah, one of the other episodes I want to do at some point, if we have the time and energy for it, is there were two movies made in the response to Dalek mania about. So we know the show Doctor Who, starring the Doctor. There were two films starring Peter Cushing, who you might know as
Scarfy McBig Scarf?
No, Grand Moff Tarkin in the Star Wars movies. You may fire when ready. That character.
Yes.
He played a character named Doctor Who. Not the Doctor. He played a character named Doctor Who in two Doctor Who and the Daleks movies that are not based on, that are loosely based on the show. Doctor Who is not the Doctor. He is not from Gallifrey. He is not a Time Lord. He is just a human scientist who takes his granddaughter on an adventure through into space with his TARDIS. That's just a room full of wires. And they go meet the Daleks. I don't know if I'll keep any of this in the actual episode because it's irrelevant to everything we've talked about. But there are two fun stories. One of which, I can't remember which one, but one of which, the climax of it is effectively the Daleks lose control and just start flailing about the place, running into each other and exploding.
Wait, Daleks can destroy each other by running into each other?
If I remember the plot point correctly, they demagnetize the floor so the Daleks can't control where they move anymore, and they just start sliding all over the place and running into walls.
It's Luigi's Rollick and Roadsters, but they've gone rogue.
Basically, yeah.
That's so funny.
Yeah. So, I don't know if I'll keep any of that in the actual
probably
end of this,
not.
But
you know, thank you for humoring me and letting me talk about somebody who I am now so obsessed with.
Yeah, that was a fun little story. I look forward to other rabbit holes you go down. I'm glad that I'm glad that this podcast has provided a platform for your rabbit holes.
Yeah, and I have every resource I used saved. I don't have formal works cited page because I am not in college anymore.
Well, I can do the citations for you. Yeah. So I'll probably take the links that you used, and I'll probably put them in the description of
either description
this episode on the podcast platforms.
Yeah, there's a There should be a place, just because there is a lot of stuff that I didn't cover.
Yeah, just something that doesn't flow
in
the
interest
story.
of also, we have already been speaking for like an hour and a half.
Oof.
Yeah,
so. This will be fun to edit.
Yep.
Well,
have fun.
Was there anything else to your story you wanted to add?
No. Oh, you know, if you are in a creative slump, don't turn to alcohol. Please don't.
Yeah, probably not. It works out for some people, but not most of them.
Yeah. I mean, that was the biggest takeaway that I got, was just, or like the part that made me so sad, is that for those 11 years, Delia was doing what she loved.
Yeah.
But after she had started, you know, times had changed, music was changing, and she decided to quit. She did have other jobs working at radio stations, bookstores. Like, she did continue to work. But the thing that she was the most excited about, making music, she could no longer do because she didn't have the
tools that
the
she
radiophonic
used.
Workshops. Yeah. Like, she didn't have access to any of that.
Yeah.
So she couldn't physically do all of the same stuff. She managed. She still made some stuff. But it's the fact that she just became really kind of sad. And,
yeah.
You know, kind of faded away, not because of time necessarily, but just because she didn't have anything to do, any stuff to make. You know, there was the one person that had reached out to her, or Sonic Boom reaching out to her, but, you know, it just makes you think.
Yeah. Well, this was
a fun deep dive.
Yeah, this was a fun little deep dive into this person's life in this. This little story that probably oft goes unacknowledged in Doctor Who circles. And I'm glad that we got to tell it here.
Yeah.
Well, Cassie got to tell it. I got to listen to it.
You claiming that this is your favorite show and you know a lot about it, but hey.
I never claimed to know everything, just a lot.
Yep. And so I've made it my new mission to find more things you don't know a lot about and make that my new hyperfixation.
Well, I look forward to what else you find.
Yeah.
And we'll find out some more stuff that you don't know about on the next episode of Who Is My Doctor?
Delia Derbyshire is my doctor.
Delia Derbyshire is indeed. You know, when I started this podcast, I knew we'd do some things besides just watch the show, but I had no idea this kind of thing could come of it. I thought this was really cool, and I really like seeing Cassie get excited about this story, and if you want to see what other cool things we could come up with, be sure to subscribe to this podcast wherever you're listening now. If you liked it as much as I did, please give us a like or 5 stars, and if you want to follow us on social media, you can find us on Twitter, Blue Sky Threads, and Instagram at WIMDPod. That's WIMDPOD. I know we originally planned to have this week be when we looked at Genesis of the Daleks, but Cassie was so excited I didn't want to make her wait any longer. But not to fear, we'll be back next Tuesday because you're... Hang on. Why is next week's episode scheduled for Monday? Tuesdays are Who's Days? What's happening on Monday?